You are listening to Punk News Podcast 373 with JJG and Tommy T and Adam White, who doesn't have a last name that rhymes with a vowel. So what are you going to do? Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and we've got the Trauma Unit here with us tonight. And first of all, the guy that makes it the Trauma Unit, we are here with Tom Trauma. Tom Trauma, what's happening? What's going on? What's the news? Blues?
You know, it's just nonstop thrills and spills over here at the Trauma House. I'm going to school events and sporting events and, driving the kids around. It's as hardcore as you can get, honestly.
Well, speaking of hardcore, we are also here with managing editor Adam White. Adam White, how hardcore were you this week?
Oh, man. All right. So here is my hardcore day. My son has a cough, and he's a two-year-old, so he is basically like the rudest person in the world, because two-year-olds have no they have like both A, no realization that the things that they do affect other people in society. And that's combined with the fact that they don't really have full control of their bodies. So basically that means like when he's got a head cold, he doesn't really understand how to blow his nose yet. So his solution is to just sit there and cough over and over again, sometimes like 30 times, and there's nothing that you can do. And because of this, like, I couldn't send him to daycare because, he'd be there for 4 seconds and they'd call me and say, like, come get your gross child. So, I hung out with him all day and we listened to a couple records, and I gave my office the illusion that I was going to work from home, and that didn't work because, you can't actually do that when you have a sick child. And I use this time to braise a roast. So that's how hardcore I am. Being home today, if money was no object, I would be like the best house husband. Like, I'm cleaning, I'm making a roast. John, that's what I want to do.
Well, but listen, all you got to do is find a nice, strong man with a stable job, and there you go.
I know.
Listen, what record did you listen to?
He was the one that demanded I put on anything. So we listened to...
Was he like, Father, would you please put on Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins live in 1957?
No. What did we put on? We put on Master Manic by the New Pornographers, so the first New Pornographers record. And then eventually he went for a nap, and what was I listening to? I was listening to the Plasma Lab record. Everyone should go listen to Plasma Lab. Plasma Lab is great. But yeah, I mean, he has enough attention span for me to put on one thing, and he's interested in it, and then he's buzzed into the other room and doing something else.
We'll get to mail in a second, but both Adam White and Tom Trauma, there's conflicting rationales and strategies here. Records. Hide them from your kids. Don't hide them from your kids. Put the expensive ones at the top. Leave them all out. Do you protect your records with your kids, or do you encourage your kid to have an engaging musical experience, even though it may put your expensive records at risk?
Well, I have the young kids. Like, Tom, did you have this problem when your kids
were? I taught my daughter how to use a record player. She was like 15. I don't think you know. I don't think you let little kids play with your records.
So where do you put them in the house?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. You have to put fear in them, John. My children know there's certain things they don't screw around with. That's it. I'm not into this hippie new age parenting bullshit. This is my stuff. Leave it alone or I'll smack you around.
Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, I my
maybe it's not
that,
maybe
my,
it's not maybe it's not that severe, but it really, you know, they know.
I like how Tom said,
I always had fear.
It's really not that severe, but it actually is what he was about to say.
Well, I always had this fear, like, so I, you know, my kids are teenagers and they'll occasionally, you know, go into tantrums, and all I can think is if they really want to hurt me, they go downstairs with a baseball bat and just. Oh God, I think I'm getting the chills right now just thinking about it. I'm shivering.
Wait, are you thinking of your children beating you to death with a baseball bat?
No, going after my record collection.
Oh, I see.
They're not gonna beat me to death. They're not gonna beat me to death, dude. I pay the bills.
all my stuff is basically at toddler arm level, but my office has a door and it's usually closed if I'm not here. So I really, they don't tend to rummage around with too much of that because it's essentially boring to them. Like, with all the things in the world that they could be playing with, the fact that I have, like, a bunch of, you know, vertical pieces of paper stacked next to each other isn't really all that interesting to them. I just have to make sure that I have the dust cover on my turntable if I'm playing music around them because they'll stand there and they'll stare at the record, and I'm sure that their little arms would like try to jam their fingers in there. And like, I don't want that.
Look, Dad, I wrote your name on your first pressing of Constantine's record with a rock. Isn't that nice?
No, like they'd prefer to write on like the walls of the house rather than
side of your car.
Which is on the one hand, is bad, but on the other hand, when we bought this house, we didn't paint it. And it's all still like builder's paint. And we're just sort of assuming that, you know, we'll hit a point where the kids are like, you know, 10 years old and all of our pets will have mercifully died. And then at that point, we're going to
they'll
just,
talk into more, dude.
We're going to paint this place, tear up all the flooring the pets have destroyed. It'll be great. That's my dream.
Well, listen, houses come.
Yeah, it is a dream, too. Let me tell you.
Houses come and go, but you're only going to have one copy of Crass's Feeding the 5,000 original press. That's what I'm saying. Listen, let's reach into the mailbag, podcast@punknews.org. We've got one posse, one neggy. Do you guys want to do the posse first or the neggy first?
Whatever. Bring it on.
All right, let's do
the negative one because then I'll feel bad, but then the positive one will make me feel good.
Okay, this is from Liverpool Neil. Hello, everyone. Liverpool Neil writes in quite frequently to yell at us. Hello, everyone. Liverpool Neil here. I just finished listening to episode 370, and I must say I think that John lost his mind halfway through that one. First, he reads a letter from some complete nutcase that defends Martin Shkreli claiming that, and this is the letter, not me claiming, this is the letter claiming that, or the post, Hillary Clinton is involved in voodoo rituals, and it is verified. WTF, why on earth would you repeat that complete nonsense? And even more to the point, why would you not belittle the writer as the complete fool that he or she is? Ignoring these kinds of insane accusations on air only adds fuel to their fire and gives their wacky story credence. I didn't defend that because I figured it was assumed that was completely insane and like I didn't feel as though I needed to defend something that is objectively not true. You know what I mean?
Was I on this episode?
You were. This was the one where I was like, there was a weird thing that people like Martin Shkreli, and you're like, who? And I started reading this one guy that was like talking about how Martin Shkreli wasn't as bad as everyone says he was and why Hillary Clinton is terrible. You know, this is like the
time. I don't remember this voodoo stuff, but okay.
This is like the time. I know Tom remembers this. During the election, like we would have these random people pop up to attack Hillary Clinton that had never been on the website before ever. It was like really weird.
No. Most of them were to defend her.
Oh, I thought they were attacking her.
No.
Oh, they were attacking Bernie Sanders. That's right. They were attacking Bernie Sanders.
They were probably some kind of, I don't know. I don't know why I sound paranoid, but I think there's some kind of operative sometimes that run to things because sometimes people show up on Punk News that we don't recognize and there'll be like 15 of them. I mean, they're mobilizing. There's some kind of an organization to it.
But do they have like a web?
I don't know what it is, but
yeah, I used to say that that's paranoid thinking, but it objectively happened at Punk News during the Democrat primaries.
There has to be some kind of an organization to it. You don't get 15 or 20 strangers. Somebody has to be alerting them to it and directing them to
it. Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's not that many people are going to stumble upon this Hillary Clinton editorial.
Yeah, Adam White.
And it's just people get so bent out of shape if they don't agree with the content, you know, the problem with a lot of millennial types is they don't agree with something. They don't think it's true. You know, they discount the truth in anything they don't agree with. It's just, ugh. Anyway, don't get me started. It's a strange phenomena.
Not to get too off track, but Adam, what you might have experienced, can you explain the phenomenon of when we had a Hillary Clinton editorial that people we'd never even heard of just popped up and stuck around the site and then disappeared for like a couple of weeks?
Yeah, is that they were all fucking Russian agents that had were pulling the same general internet propaganda game that they're pulling everywhere else, and I totally believe that. But no, okay, continue Liverpool Neil's letter. Let's just add here that, yes, it is the opinion of the Punk News podcast that Hillary Clinton is not a voodoo priestess or whatever.
And actually, not to mention, hasn't my entire bend on Martin Shkreli being how much I think he's a jerk? Like, like every article I refer to him as, like, verified douchebag and, like, loser. Well, douche. Well, I call him douchebag. That's the extent of my vocabulary. He's douchebag. If I don't like somebody. Well, so anyways, listen. Continuing with Liverpool.
Anyways, continue. Continue. I don't think you've gotten your full drubbing yet.
Secondly, John staunchly defended Rolling Stone, the biggest joke of a rock magazine that has ever existed. Ricky said that he was happy it was going away, and I back him 1,000% on that. It is and has always been a complete joke. Completely out of touch, and the voice of AOR, I don't know what the, oh, Album Oriented Rock and Dinosaur Rock.
Yeah.
And it was always very anti-punk, something that I'm very surprised you didn't pick up on, John. Other American music magazines in the late 70s, like Cream, actually covered the scene, and in New York, the London covered the punk scene in New York and London, but Rolling Stone purposely avoided both. They neither understood nor enjoyed punk rock, and instead they buried their shaggy heads in a pile of cocaine and Fleetwood Mac records. And for you to say that they invented modern music journalism is simply outrageous. The NME, New Music Express in England, had existed for 15 years before Rolling Stone. Melody Maker longer than that. Rolling Stone is the print equivalent of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a horrendous dinosaur that needs to go away. Come on, John, get with the program. Love the show, and as always, stay free. I gotta disagree with Liverpool Neil here. Rolling Stone magazine certainly did invent modern music journalism. NME and Melody Maker did exist before Rolling Stone. However, they covered bands in the PR and or the tabloid manner. Like, what's Davy Jones up to today? Isn't he cute? No music magazine prior to Rolling Stone treated musicians, rock musicians, in what we would call the Gay Talese style. And if you haven't read Gay Talese's foundational point, Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, you should read that. It is probably the greatest piece of musical writing ever, called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. And Rolling Stone magazine took that style and applied it to rock journalism and also brought in political opinion and basically made it a much more heavy, profound, interesting magazine. And frankly, the interviews are the best. The profiles are the best. Did Rolling Stone magazine kind of ignore punk? It did. But listen, Rolling Stone magazine still is a phenomenal magazine. I'm sad that it's kind of, you know, it's in its last few years. It's you know, kind of a shambling along till its inevitable end, probably in a couple of years. And I think that's sad. And I will not back down from the position that Rolling Stone magazine is the best music magazine, because I think it is. And I think history proves that.
One of my favorite things that I saw on Twitter when the sale of Rolling Stone was announced, or whatever the last piece of news that came up, was someone quoted someone that had your opinion, John, your high opinion of it. And they responded by just including a series of four Rolling Stone covers, all of which featured Bob Seger. It's just like, it was something just about how, like, edgy and interesting Rolling Stone was, and they're like, yeah, Bob Seger's on the cover fucking all the time. Why is this? I don't know where I come down on this. There was a while when I was in college when I had a Rolling Stone subscription, because I don't know if this happens in the States, but, like, up here, like, a lot of the times kids will sell magazine subscriptions as, like, a charity thing, and no one wants magazine subscriptions, so you can get them for, you know, an incredibly cheap price. And there was a while where I was getting Rolling Stone, and there was, like, I was on the one hand surprised by some of the contents of it that did meet the laudable position of journalism that you're lumping onto them, John. Like, there's a lot of really cool investigative journalism and stuff that they were doing, and there was some decent music related things that were in there as well. And then there was also a lot of fluff that I didn't really care about. So I don't know, like, the real answer to this is probably somewhere up the middle, unfortunately. But hey,
So I'm with Liverpool Neil on this, and I've spoke before. I grew up in rural Wisconsin. I love Rolling Stone. We had it in our high school library, and man, I bought a lot of records just based on the reviews. I mean, I remember buying the first Soundgarden. It wasn't the first, but Louder Than Love in like 1988 or 89 or whatever it was, just because I read a review of it. Or Jane's Addiction's Nothing Shocking. I read the review of it and I bought the album without any way of hearing it at the time before it had anything on the radio. So I loved that growing up. But the fact of the matter is, once I discovered other things, I kicked it to the curb. I have no use for it. I have no use for their political writing. I have no use for their music writing. I don't really have any use for them. I mean, it's still got the name still has a certain amount of cachet, but as far as reading it, nah.
Well, this is from Robo Chicken. Here's what Robo Chicken has to say. Hello, Punk News, first time, long time. Tom is one of my favorite reviewers. I just read his review of the Sloppy Seconds split single, and I wanted to write in about it. I think he didn't address the record's most important point. One song...
My God, that just ran today, right?
Yeah, we just got this like 2 hours ago. I think he didn't address the record's most important point. One song on the record by Sloppy Seconds was an old song, and on the split side was two new songs by Danger Bird. This kind of presentation annoyed me. I think now that music is readily available online, bands don't need to scramble together split releases. Split releases are cool, but they should have a purpose. Why are these two songs put together? Also, the one song on one side and two songs on the other bothers me. Two and three songs is okay, but maybe it is my OCD, but one song and two song on the other side always feels underbaked to me. What is Tom's opinion on how split releases should be set up? Thanks and love listening from Robo Chicken.
Well, Robo Chicken, I agree with you on the one song to two song thing. I have the OCD with that too. But here's the thing with this particular release. Nobody knows who Danger Bird is. And Sloppy Second has a name, and I kind of addressed that in the review. I think what they're going for here, Failure Records and Tapes, who's definitely a label that I'm keeping my eye on, out of Logansport, Indiana. Seem like cool dudes. Some friends of mine have something coming out in there. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I think they just the unknown band is having their name attached to the bigger band, because there are people like me who will buy anything that has, you know, a new Sloppy Second song on it, and then I'll get to check out the Danger Birds. The next time I'm at the record store, if God somehow there's a Danger Bird record and I see it, I might put two and two together. The first one was the Queers, and I can't say what's coming next, but I know the next couple or another couple of big punk rock bands attached to up and coming punk bands. So really, the advantage is, you know, the unknown punk band gets to be attached to this bigger band. And for like Sloppy, you know, they probably give them records to sell at the show. They get this old song that they didn't have anything to do with, and they stuck it on this record, and then they sell the 7-inches for $10 at the show, you know? So I think it's a win-win, and I still like splits. I think I'm more compulsive about buying splits. If I got a choice and I see two 7-inches and they each have two songs on them, and one is two songs by a band I like and one is one song by a band I like and a band I never heard, I'm almost always want to go behind door number two and hear the, you know, the new Strange Band song. So I love splits. I'm all for them.
Adam, any opinion on splits?
I like splits. I've expressed this before. I mean, Tom did it well, so I won't go too deeply into it. But I'm generally a big fan of them. If for no other reason than it shows context, and I like context with my music. If there's two bands that are on a split together, there's a good chance that those are two bands from, you know, from the same town, from the same scene, from the same label. Like, there's some connective tissue between those two bands that has resulted in them being on that split together. And I think that when you look at a band's discography and you see the other bands that they've done split releases with, it's very telling. It gives some context about like their time and place in, you know, in this giant musical narrative and that we're always in the middle of. And I like that kind of stuff. I kind of get off on the connection between bands and the, you know, knowing that, oh, this band was on this label and they were influenced by this band from this label that was really influential. Like, all that kind of stuff I think is super fascinating, and splits kind of drive that home. So I'm pro splits. The other thing that I like about it, and this is actually why I like EPs in general, is just that you get the nice side effect of having limited space. So a band can only put, you know, three or four songs on their side. And generally that means they're not putting a lot of filler on there, you know, too often. And I mean, I don't write a lot of reviews these days, but you know, both you guys will, you know, can vouch for this, but like most of the time when you have a record that is bad, like a record that is not good, that you're going to, where you can see what the band was trying to do, but it's like a two and a half star record. In almost every case, there's a good EP worth of shit on there, and then there's a bunch of other stuff. And you can just see the missed opportunity to put out something that would have been like concise and cool, and that was thrown away because they felt they needed to make like a full length. So I'm all for EPs.
With split EPs, I honestly usually only listen to one side. I'll listen to the other side, and if it doesn't grab me right away, I usually won't listen to it. Split EPs can be very, very cool, but to me, there does have to have a purpose. Like, why are these two bands together? And also, I agree that it really annoys me. It was like one song on one side and three on another. Like, I kind of want the split EP or the split 12 inch. Why are these together? And these were made for split, not just some stuff slapped on. That's my opinion on splits. Honestly, I rarely actually get into new bands because of the split. I usually just listen to the side of the band I like and don't really pay attention to the other. I mean, I spin it once, but anyways,
the other thing I will say about the split, when you got two local bands, probably share fans to begin with, but they can split the cost of pressing a record.
Yeah, like,
and I think that's a big thing because it's pretty expensive to get vinyl records pressed.
Well, so that's true.
Anyway, splits rule.
The splits do rule, and so do sloppy seconds. So anyway, speaking of splits, I'm gonna play a song that's kind of
sloppy seconds are my Melvins, John. I keep beating the drum.
Actually, Tom, you know, the last two sloppy seconds CDs are really hard to find, and I was at a record convention this weekend, and I got them both for $3 each, the last two sloppy seconds CDs.
Nice.
Good records. The first one's definitely the best, but they're all pretty good if you ask me.
Yeah. The first one and the last one are the best, but the two in the middle are good too.
So anyways, you can always reach the podcast at punknews.org, and I'm going to do the opposite of a split. I'm going to do a combo release. The song I'm about to play actually is available. Somebody threw it somewhere, like on a compilation somewhere. And also, it was actually briefly released for UK Record Store Day 2016, but it never really made any kind of a splash whatsoever. It's kind of a long-lost, awesome track. This is a track by Iggy Pop called Fire Engine. Tom or Adam, have you guys ever heard of Fire Engine by Iggy Pop?
No.
It is a really cool track recorded in 1983, and it's Iggy Pop produced by Rick Ocasek. So it was kind of pitched as Iggy Pop and Rick Ocasek from the Cars, but it isn't really, really Iggy Pop and Rick Ocasek from the Cars. Do you guys know who Rick Ocasek worked with pretty frequently, 1980, 1981, 1982, 1983, particularly on the first two Alan Vega records?
I guess Alan Vega. Is that Suicide?
Rick Ocasek produced Alan Vega of Suicide's record, but do you know who kind of did all the music for those two records?
I guess I don't.
Al Jorgensen before he was Al Jorgensen.
Oh, Ministry, yes.
The famous story is Ministry's first unreleased single from like 1980 was a very nasty, almost chrome-type release. The record label didn't like it, and they had him go back and basically make a synth-pop record, which he hates, which I think is pretty good. Meanwhile, the record label was kind of using Al Jorgensen as – they were kind of grooming him to be a next big pop star or to kind of be the studio musician that makes pop stars be pop stars, and he never really fit into either of those two things. Although it is interesting that at one time Al Jorgensen, they were kind of grooming him to be kind of like Tears for Fears or something. Anyway, so the record company kind of would use Al Jorgensen as the connector between Far Out dudes and pop music. Basically, he could act as the liaison between the record company that wanted pop music and the Far Out guy like Alan Vega. Another great example is this track called Fire Engine, which is Iggy Pop produced by Rick Ocasek with Al Jorgensen producing the music. And there were plans to do a whole album, but it fell apart after this one single. I think there might be a B-side. I'm not sure. And so I'm just going to play this track. If you read Punk News in early November, you'll see why we learned about this track. But this is a really cool track. It's Iggy Pop, Al Jorgensen, and Rick Ocasek doing Fire Engine from 1983. And honestly, it would have been, without question, Iggy Pop's third best solo album. Maybe second best. Let's check it out.
Fire engine, get back in the race. I gotta be the first one to my baby's place. Fire engine, won't you turn me
And we're back, and that was Iggy Pop doing Fire Engine. Did you guys enjoy my laborious and drawn out intro to that song?
Always enjoy that.
Okay, so let's get into the news, boys. Kind of a slow news week this week, which is good. That gives us time to bullshit. Speaking of Record Store Day, the Record Store Day, Black Friday Record Store Day releases have been released. It's mostly reissues this time around. Not a whole lot of new stuff. There's reissues from Neil Young, Ryan Adams, Anthrax, Iggy Pop, Lee Scratch Perry, Mike Watt, Flesh Tones, and some other stuff. Not a whole lot of punk this time, and really not a whole lot of new music, mostly reissue. There's new music from DMC, if that's your thing. Adam White, Tom Trauma, were you guys into this list, or did this list, was it snoozeroony?
Oh, it was horrible, man. I got through the first one, then I started going through the second one. It was just, ugh. I mean, I might go to the record store that day, but nothing in that list is going to get bought by me.
Yeah, this seems pretty. It's either pretty weak or pretty boring, and
or both.
Like, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of this RSD first concept that they have right now. I mean, I get why they're doing it, and it's. I mean, it's cool that they're giving these indie stores these releases first. I mean, don't get me wrong, but they're not exciting. Like. Does anyone desperately need like a reissue of like Neil Young's Harvest Moon? I mean, like that's a fine thing to have, but like, do you need to go, you know, get in line that day to get a copy of it? No, I'm going to say no. And there's, I mean, and some of the things that like I could be tempted to purchase are in this list, but they're still like, I almost feel like I would be buying them just to buy something. So, you know, you're going to twist my arm and stick me in the store that day. I'm going to go, okay, I don't own a copy of Blank Generation on vinyl, so I may as well get the 40th anniversary reissue that you're selling today.
For $50.
I guess. But on the other hand, that again, it's one of these like these RSD first things. Like that will be available elsewhere and, you know, probably dramatically price cut in a week. So, I don't know. There was nothing super interesting on here outside of that. It's like you said, it's a lot of reissues, and I'm generally for the whole Record Store Day concept. It's just, I don't know, weak list. What can you do?
Yeah, I agree. You know me, I'm usually pretty pro Record Store Day, but as I always say, the point of Record Store Day is for me to release new interesting things that you could not release otherwise because the demand isn't there, but because of the demand created by Record Store Day, you're able to put out neat stuff. Best examples would be Off Live Record, Sublime Rarities, Tegan and Sarah B-Sides. That's all stuff I want to see on Record Store Day. Here, this is all just, I'm just not into like reissues of commonly available records at all. Like, you can get Harvest Moon anytime you want. You don't need to get it on Chuck Berry, London Chuck Berry Sessions. You can get that anytime you want. Iggy Pop's New Values, it's not even that good of a record. You can get that anytime you want. Janis Joplin's Greatest Hits, you can get that anytime you want. There's really nothing that special here at all. The one thing, this will probably be the first Record Store Day that I blow off entirely, but I might go for this one thing. They're doing a re-release of Lee Scratch Perry's Disco Devil 12-inch single. This actually is probably my favorite reggae song of all time. It might be my favorite song of all time, definitely my favorite reggae song of all time. It's a really weird, very trippy 9-minute, 7-minute long, I think it's like 7-minute long song, and it is basically the, if you ask me, the archetypical reggae 12-inch disco mix, which basically it starts out as the normal song and then gets weirder and weirder as it goes along, and it's certainly fitting for a 12-inch single. I've got this on CD in multiple locations. I don't have it on vinyl. The B-side on the original was actually a really rare Bob Marley track. It was Keep On Moving, but it was Bob Marley and this guy called Wong Chu, and I don't know who Wong Chu is. I've never heard the song, so I'll be interested to see what they put on side B. It might be, I would be bummed out if it's just Disco Devil on both sides, but if it's something else on side B, that'd be cool too. But then again, I don't want to be spending $30 on a song. You know what I mean? Like, I almost bought the Rolling Stones thing last time, and that was like literally $35 for one song, and I had to put it back, you know? But other than that, is Record Store Day, I think, is beneficial towards record stores. For a while, record stores were saying it was bad for them, then they were saying it was good for them. Now it seems like they're saying it was bad for them. I really don't see people. I do see people going to the store to get these reissues, but I feel people going home feeling very not satisfied with these purchases. You know, good job. You spent $40 on a Neil Young record. You could have spent $7 on, you know, like.
The one thing on the list here that strikes me as both a new thing and something that I would consider buying was there's a 10-inch being put out. From the Black Lips, are they from Atlanta? The Atlanta-based like garage punk band. And so here we go. A limited edition 10-inch produced by Sean Lennon, of all people, with two new songs from the band and then a couple remixes. That's the kind of thing that I'm expecting to find when I do a Record Store Day. Like, I want to go in. I want to find some weird release that, you know, wouldn't be put out otherwise, that was sort of assembled just for, you know, the fact that they're having this event, and isn't something that I'm going to turn around and find all those songs elsewhere in a month, you know? So that's all I got. Spin, John.
There you have it. I agree. This is very underwhelming list this year. Speaking of something that's not underwhelming, and speaking of a record that I am excited about, and speaking of something that does have limited edition versions, Screaming Females, they've detailed their new album. The new album is going to be called All at Once. It's out February 23rd via their long-running record label, Don Giovanni. It was produced by the guy from Mastodon. I forget his name that they used for the last record, Rose Mountain. I know Adam White and I were both big fans of Rose Mountain. Not so sure about Tom Trauma. I don't remember. The album is a double LP, their first double LP, and their longest LP by far. But not only that, there's a deluxe edition that comes with a whole third album that includes demos and a 7-inch that includes their AV Club sessions, If It Makes You Happy, which I think is a Sheryl Crow song, and Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. Both were really neat versions. Then there's a super, super, super deluxe edition that I wanted to get but I think was sold out that is the same as the deluxe edition but comes with a hand-drawn cover by singer-guitarist Marissa Paternoster. I'm excited for this. They also released a new song. The new song is called, let's see here,
Glass Houses.
Glass Houses, and it features a bottle getting smashed over Marissa Paternoster's head. I'm excited for this release, but I'll let you guys go first.
I'll go first because I don't know much. I only listened to this song, but it didn't do anything for me, honestly, John.
Get off the podcast.
I know you're real excited about this. I saw him real briefly one time. Like, I showed up late, like I sometimes do to a show, because usually it's cheaper to drink somewhere outside of the show. And they were actually opening for Against Me, and it was I don't know, 3-4 years ago. So I saw them briefly, but it didn't do anything for me.
Boo. We hate you, Tom.
John, you and I are huge fans of Rose Mountain. Rose Mountain is one of my favorites.
Does Rose Mountain rock harder than Glass Houses?
Yeah.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, it does. Check it out. Okay. There's definitely the band got more studio time or space or however you want to phrase it for this record. So they're sort of indulging in all of their various weird impulses on this one. But Rose Mountain was tight. I hate to sound like a press release asshole, but like it's chock full of hits, Tom. Every song on there has got a big.
Because this song was like 4 minutes long, and it just didn't do anything for me. But yeah, I mean, listen, dudes, different strokes. You know, we might have this conversation again a little later in the episode. So. About a different.
Anyways, band. Though, but yeah. So I mean, I'm a fan of this band. Glasshouse didn't do a whole hell of a lot for me, but it's the kind of thing that I think I got to listen to a few more times to, you know, to kind of figure out where it's going. But man, I'm excited for this. I sort of want to pre-order it. I'm not a big pre-order person because I assume I can. I don't know. Like I never need like the weird color vinyl variant of anything. Like. If it's a record that I want, I kind of want the record, and I don't really care what version of it I get. But I kind of want to buy the pre-order of this that's going to have that 7-inch, because if for no other reason, that cover of Shake It Off that they did for the AV Cubs Undercover series is great. Like, I love that version of that song. And if anything, that's probably what sold Screaming Females off to me when I wasn't super aware of them. So I sort of want that.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this record. I think this record, like Rose Mountain had like 4 or 5 hits on it, if you will. I don't know if this record's going to have hits on it, because I think it's going to be more experimental. And I think it's going to be more of a Zen Arcade type album, if you will, basically. An album made to be an album. And Adam White is often like, cut it down to an EP, cut it down to a single. I think this will be a double album that needs to be a double album, and I'm very excited for this, and I think Screaming Females are cool. And also, I think this is the right move for them to make, because Rose Mountain was a rocker. But can you out-rock the rocker twice in a row? The answer is most bands can't. But you can do the weird experimental thing, which I think they're doing, and I think they're in a good place. And I think this is a double album forebodes that they are in a very interesting artistic place, because it seemed to be a double album, not because they had to do a double album, but because they wanted to do a double album. So I'm very excited for this.
Yeah, I'm not unexcited. So I can't wait to hear more about this. It's one of the main things I'm looking forward to next year.
Are you eating again, Adam?
I am right now.
Oh, you bastard.
Well, my wife silently walked in here, gave me a bowl of popcorn.
Nice.
And I said, yay, I have a bowl of popcorn. And then on the other hand, I said, fuck, now I have to try to eat this bowl of popcorn and be on the podcast and not be rude about it.
I wish my wife would walk in here right now with an ice cold beer, but I don't think I have any in the fridge.
We used to have one guy that would eat chicken wings. Anyways, this is a big Ricky Frankel band. I know Adam White is a fan of this comedy show, but I don't know if he's a fan of this band or not. The band, The Eradicator, have released a video for their song, Squash Queen. The song is off their new self-titled album, which is out now via Stonewall. Of course, this is a reference to an Kids in the Hall sketch. I think there's only one sketch, but maybe Adam White knows more than I do about a guy that plays squash but actually isn't very good. And also, Adam White, is squash more popular in Canada than racquetball? Because in America, racquetball is way more popular than squash.
I know so little about them that I'm not entirely sure what the difference between those two things is.
You know,
which is the one where you go into a room and you hit a ball against the wall.
See, I think they're both in a room. Both squash and racquetball.
Squash and
the difference.
They use the same court, if you will, but the lines are different.
Let me see. Squash.
Anyways, do you guys like this or not?
Squash versus racquetball.
You know, I was gonna. If you wanted to do, you know, sometimes somebody wrote in a while back, and I'm like listening back to old podcasts because I'm way, way, way behind. But somebody said we need more live reviews on the podcast, and I was gonna say if we're gonna do live reviews this week, I would talk about going to see The Eradicator Sunday.
Go ahead.
It's not a they. It is a they, but it's really a he. It's really one guy. His band kind of is whoever's available to him, or he also plays solo, like, to his laptop. But he just put out his new. Anyway, I'm gonna refer to him as he. That's my pronoun choice. So, put out his new album. Just came out Friday, the 14th of October, 13th of October. I can't remember what it was. Yeah, Friday the 13th. So he did a release show in Chicago, and then his second release show was actually in Grand Rapids. So for a Sunday matinee. So we went over there, a friend of mine and I, and drank beer in the middle of the sunny afternoon and watched a couple local bands that were both really good, that being 78 Revolutions Per Minute and The Bloody Lips, who I've written about extensively, and you're probably sick of by now. But then the Bloody Lips also backed the Eradicator as a live band, plus this guy Ryan, who was the drummer for Galactic Cannibal and also played on the new album, played bass. So he played bass, and both the guys from the Bloody Lips played guitar, and Josh played drums. And it was a real good time, and I was really excited about it, actually, because another Chicago band that the main guy from the Eradicator and also played, a band called Bad Mechanics, who does... They might be the closest thing to a modern like Devo. I think they're really great. I reviewed their album earlier this year. It's really funny, subversive, new wave, synth driven. And I know I'm usually not a big synth pop guy, but man, it's really, really great stuff. And it was a lot of fun. It was a good show. And thing with the Eradicator, it's absolutely a gimmick, but at the end of the day, I think the chops are good and the songs are good, and it's a fun show. So I am an Eradicator fan. I kind of wrestled with it for a while, but it kind of reminds me of, like, I never watched Kids in the Hall, so I'm going to use Saturday Night Live as my example instead. Like, when you're watching Saturday Night Live and you're watching a skit and you're like, oh, this is super funny, and then after a while you're like, oh, this is going on way too long. But then it keeps going, and then it comes back again where it gets funny again. To me, that's the Eradicator. It's just... Anyway, I dig it. I like the people involved with it. I think it's a cool thing. I think the video is fun, too.
You may have said this, and I totally... I'm not actually listening to you. But what was the other band that the singer here was in? Like, ATFO was the acronym for it.
ATFO.
Does anyone know this?
Okay, the singer for who?
I was trying to figure out who the main guy from the Eradicator. Like, what was he in outside of that Mechanics band?
He, you know, a couple other things that I didn't. I can't even remember. I have a record. Let me see. He played in a band called Tension Generation when he was very young. Just, I have the LP in front of me. He played in Galactic Cannibal. Andy played in Galactic Cannibal.
That's it. That's his main band.
He played bass. No, but he wasn't the main guy. He played guitar. I don't think he sang in anything necessarily that you would know before the Eradicator. But okay. He's in with the guys from Direct Hit and some other kind of notable musicians like that.
All right. So I don't know what I was thinking with that acronym. I mean, like, where I'm getting at with this is like, so yeah, I'm a fan of this. This is cool. I've not really delved too far into it. So I don't know what my tolerance is for more than this individual song that we have the video for. But like, you know, I like the song. I like the video. I think it's fun and aggressive and goofy in a way that a lot of, you know, punk rock shies away from being. I'm, of course, you know, as a Canadian, I am fully on board with Kids in the Hall influencing the wider cultural landscape as much as they possibly can. So that, you know, that's great. I'm good for that. I have always had this feeling, and I know Ricky's really big on this band. Not having paid too much attention, I've had this feeling that like, it was going to turn out that like, oh, this is someone from a band that I'm really not all that interested in, and that was going to color it for me. But it doesn't sound like that's the case. So I'm down.
Well, there you have it. Adam White is down. Speaking of things,
Adam White is down.
Speaking of things people are down with, Tom Trauma, play a song that you are down with.
I'm down with the sickness.
All right, here we go. Drowning
I'm going
pool.
To play Disturbed. No, you know what? I'm going to play a Bad Mechanics song because I like them so much. And like I said, this is a real a Devo worship, maybe a little like They Might Be Giants. It's really clever. I think you kind of pick something up lyrically a little more every time you listen to it. And so their album came out in September, and it's called Precious Moments in the USA. And I am going to do, this is my new theme song in life. This song is called Social Obligation. So this is Social Obligation from Bad Mechanics.
No social obligations!
Was Tom Trauma playing the Bad Mechanics song Social Obligation. Tom Trauma, what social obligations have you had recently?
You cut out on me, John. Ask me again.
Oh, what social obligations have you had recently?
Oh, well, dude, my life is like 90% social obligations. So, or at least familial obligations. But anyway, Hey, I want to do one more thing real quick because I'm listening. Like I said, I'm listening to all these old podcasts, and a guy or kid or somebody wrote in from St. Ignace, and his name was Joe. So I want to give a shout out to fellow Michigander Joe in St. Ignace. Hey, Joe. Hope you're still listening 6 months later after I heard the original or podcast.
Michigander?
Well, there you go. Michigander?
That's it, I guess. That's what we call ourselves.
Huh.
I mean, I don't call myself that very often, but...
I mean, every once in a while you'll hear... There's a word for this, too, and I forget what the actual word is, but like what the noun is for this, but there is a... There's a term for what you call a person from a certain place. Is it like, it's going to drive me crazy. And there are certain cities that do, or certain states or whatever, that do not at all translate into what you would expect them to. And then it turns out that the actual term is really fucking bizarre. And if I had like all the time, if I was an immortal and I had just to like kill all the time in the world, I would spend so much time looking into that shit because it is weird.
I like Highlander. He's out like sword fighting evil guys and destroying evil. Adam White chooses his time to look up things on Wikipedia.
Well, I mean, like once you've destroyed all the evil, you're still immortal. What are you going to do? You should look this shit up.
I'll tell you what I would do. I just read a news piece this week that had the best bar in every one of Michigan's 83 counties. I would go drink a drink at least at every one of those bars in every one of those 83 counties. That's what I would do, Adam.
The word I'm looking for is
well, demonym. Listen, it's
demonym.
There you go. Demographics, I guess. Speaking of things that make people want to drink, Green Day's putting out a new greatest hits album. It's called Greatest Hits.
Sag, John.
It's called Greatest Hits, God's Favorite Band. It's out November 17. It includes two new tracks. One is a track called Ordinary World with Miranda Lambert, and the other is Back in the USA. Might be a Chuck Berry song, might not be. We're not exactly sure. It's got pretty much all the big hits.
Is Ordinary World the Duran Duran song?
It might be. You
remember that Duran Duran song? Ordinary World? Or Back in the USSA was famously covered by MC5.
And also Michael J. Fox on Back to the Future.
He covered Back in the... No, Johnny B. Goode. He did Johnny B. Goode.
Did you slip...
Whatever. I mean, it's the same riff, but it's still two different songs.
Tom, did you just slip there and say Back in the USSA?
Oh.
maybe. I don't know. I'm a Russian operative, dudes.
Yeah, I guess. all right, so...
So I'm not buying this.
Oh, you know what? Hey, here's the thing about Green Day, and we always bring Green Day up, and then we make fun of them because they're easy targets, and we figure that they'll be good sports about it because they've had massive astronomical success in life, and why do they care what we think?
We're gum under their shoes. They don't care.
What if Billy Joel like actually loves the Punk News podcast, and every time we trash Green Day, he's like, oh.
He's crying.
Well, no, but that's kind of what I wanted to get at, is that like I think like to a good segment of the universe and people that are completely good people, Green Day is still a band that matters a lot to them. You could totally be a fan of Green Day still, and it doesn't make you, you know, it doesn't make you a dummy per se. Like it's not like you know, I'm not going to make fun of you like if you were a massive fan of you know, like Fall Out Boy or one of those bands that was clearly like a generation after mine, because then I can go, oh, you dumb kids in your pop band. Like, you know, like Green Day was the band when I grew up, so I kind of get it. I don't begrudge you if they're still your thing, but man, I look at this track listing. It is 22 songs. I stop at 11. Like exactly halfway is like, okay, there's my Green Day, and then midway, and there's the Green Day that I have no interest in listening to after that. And that's I don't know if that says anything about me or says something about the band. They've already had a greatest hits record at some point. It was called
International Super Hits. International
Super Hits. Yeah. Super Hits.
Now, which on the one hand, it says how dumb greatest hit records are if you're still a going band, because then you end up with these weird in-between records where, like, it's like now International Super Hits is sort of useless to anyone, right? Because this is now the greatest hits record. I don't know. I hate it when bands do that. And I never seen, I can't think of anyone where it's like they've done it well, like where it hasn't turned out to be some sort of like awkward artifact that no one really wants after the fact.
You really need to do like the greatest hits volume 1, volume 2.
Well, like
I can think of a great example, boys. Tom Petty's greatest hits. Phenomenal greatest hits, released about 2/3 of the way through his career, still holds up, still doesn't feel awkward because it's bulletproof.
Well, like, I was thinking of, like, Public Image Limited. I'm eating popcorn again, if you can't tell. Public Image Limited, they had one called The Greatest Hits So Far. And it was, again, like, far enough in their career. And given how much of, like, a typical Pill record is full of, like, half-unlistenable weird shit, that actually going through and collecting all of these singles from them, like, it made a huge amount of sense. And they... You know, they cheekily named it The Greatest Hits So Far because they're saying, yeah, we may have to come back to the well on this later. I don't know. This one, it feels like because they needed to fit in these 12 songs from the post-Warning era, that there is things that should legitimately be on here from the early part of their career that just have to be cut for length now. And if nothing else, that disappoints me. I mean, that said, I would not be purchasing this, so I don't know why I'm disappointed. But anyways, though, come back to what I was saying earlier, where how, like, you know, there's people that like this band, and, you know, I hate to bum them out. And there's a comment that's, like, in the Punk News comments that totally, like, I read it, and I thought, like, oh, now I feel bad, and I didn't even say anything bad. Where everyone's coming in and shitting on this, like, God's favorite band title. And you know, and complaining about how, you know, I don't know if anyone actually thinks that's like a serious title, but, you know, they just chipping at Green Day for, I guess, not being cool enough to sell the sarcasm of that title. And they sort of sound tooly with it. Well, someone came in and where is it here? It's the last comment here. It's from someone that I think, like, doesn't normally comment on Punk News, just showed up, saw their band was being shit on, and was like, God's favorite band isn't self-proclaimed. It's a reference to their appearance on Stephen Colbert. God appears on the ceiling from time to time, as he did that night there, and they were referred to as his favorite band in that segment. I guess all the negative comments are from people that didn't see that, right? And I'm looking at that and going, like, aw, like, this person's like, this is a band they like. They understand the in-joke. It's an in-joke. And everyone that's raging about the title doesn't get that joke. Now, again, maybe that's Green Day's fault for picking, like, an obtuse reference to be the title of the record. But on the other hand, you know, whenever you go and you, like, reactively just shit on something, there's some, you know, well-meaning soul out there that's not going to shit on it, and now they feel bad. So I don't know. I saw that and I was like, ah, there's like someone that genuinely cares.
I am interested about the financial aspect of this, and that Greatest Hits used to be total cash cows. That's why there's like 10 Billy Joel Greatest Hits albums, but like no, or like one official live Billy Joel record. Like I want so many different Billy Joel live records, especially during his classic period. But Greatest Hits make 20-fold the amount of money that live records do. However, now in the I was about to say Napster era, but now in the Spotify era or whatever, like, I don't think Greatest Hits albums really sell at all, because the kids aren't going to buy this. They'll just listen to it on Spotify. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be like a Christmas stocking stuffer. Best Buy will be selling them for like $4.
That's true. That's true.
Or whatever.
Well, speaking of crass commercialism, Iron Maiden, Iron Maiden is expanding their art into bold new areas. That's right. Iron Maiden is now a part of the Angry Birds franchise. From October 18th, which is today, through Halloween, you'll be able to download Eddie, Iron Maiden's mascot, and play him as a character on Angry Birds Evolution, which I guess is a kind of Angry Birds. What's a couple of interesting things about this is in punk rock, we poo-poo anytime anybody tries to make any money. But in heavy metal, or even mainstream heavy metal, well, actually, well, in the 80s and 90s heavy metal, like making money anyway, like you could would be thought of as cool. Like if Against Me put out like a soda, people would be like, this is cheesy and stupid. But if Iron Maiden put out a soda, people would be like, oh, this is great. I love Iron Maiden soda. This is so great that Iron Maiden's putting out a soda. I have to have that soda. I don't know what that's indicative of. But however, if a band puts out a beer now, people are like, oh, that's so great, you're putting out a beer, which is the exact same thing. But second, Tom Trom, this goes out to you. I'm assuming you're a Maiden fan, but maybe not. I'm a Maiden fan, not as much as I used to be. Definitely more a Deano fan than a Bruce Dickinson fan. Does this tarnish Maiden's legacy?
Did you say you're more of a Deano fan than a Dickinson fan?
By far. And just this weekend, I was at
the. You like those first two albums better than the stuff that. Oh, you're crazy, dude.
Yeah, I do. I think they're less cheesy, and I think they're a little bit raw, and that's why I like them.
Well, they didn't have the money, the budget, but I mean, the first two albums are great, but they don't stand up to Number of the Beast or Power Slave or anything. Anyway, I'm a big Maiden through the 80s fan.
So
I would say,
is this stupid?
In early 90s.
Does this tarnish their legacy, or is it just Maiden doing what Maiden does and what Maiden fans expect?
Dude, they already have a giant, like, they have a mascot. You know, I don't think they can really. You know, I mean, and Eddie kind of changes from album to album. No, I think it's fine. I mean, they have beer. They have a brand of beer that's fairly common to buy. And no, I think it's fine. I think it's silly. But yeah, you know, it's fine. I don't think they are going to tarnish their legacy in any way. I think they could do just about anything.
Adam White, should punk bands get in on this? Should punk bands just start selling out or licensing their name to anything they can to make some money?
John, what do you call a person from Halifax?
Halifaxian.
A Halifaxian is what I would say.
Halifax, you call them a Haligonian.
Adam is no longer here. Adam's not here anymore. I see him talking out of his.
I don't want to talk like about
the,
Iron Maiden,
like
man.
The kid from The Shining. No, you know, it's funny, John. You know, because that Eradicator show that I was just talking about earlier, he did a with the album. They did a limited edition hot sauce. And
yeah,
I should have bought it because I could have reviewed it, but I didn't end up picking up a bottle.
You know, we did.
It was $8. It was $8 for a little bottle.
We did a review of Punk Rock Hot Sauces once about 4 or 5 years ago.
Did we? But, well, I would totally do it again.
Tom Trauma, why is it cool to put out beer and hot sauce if you're punk rock, but not like, I don't know, and shirts? Why is it cool to put out shirts, but not like
I don't think it, apps? I don't, John, I think all those old rules are kind of thrown out now anyway. When I was growing up in the scene, even in the 90s, man, it was like certain things punk bands couldn't do, you know, but I think all that shit's out the window. I think anything anybody can do to make it to the next stop on their money-losing tour is okay now.
Speaking of bands that are about to go on a tour, Dead Ending, they're going to put out a new release. This will be like Dead Ending number.
I hope, John, don't tease me and say they're going to go on tour. I have no reason to believe that they're going to go on tour, but if they did, that would be awesome.
Well, Dead Ending, it's a band that's been on Alternative Tentacles for a number of years. It's Vic Bondi of Articles of Faith on vocals, Derek Grant of Alkaline Trio, Jeff Dean of The Bomb, and Nathan Voorhees of Ensign and Vision, New Jersey punk rockers Vision. They've got a new album coming out on November 17, Alternative Tentacles. It's called Shoot the Messenger. I don't know if we got a whole lot to say about this, but this is a straight-up punk rock ripper. And it is modern hardcore, done very well, very tastefully, and very effectively, if you ask me.
Old,
yeah, it's
hardcore
good.
Guys making great hardcore still.
Speaking of old guys,
yeah, there's not a lot to say about this. You're right. I mean, if you, the listener of this podcast, have not gone and checked out the Dead Ending song, you should go check out the Dead Ending song. It's really good.
Speaking of old guys that are taking a risk. Guar have released a new song. It's called "I'll Be Your Monster." It's off the new album out this Friday. The new album is called "The Blood of Gods," and of course, we've talked about this fairly in depth. I've had mixed emotions myself. This is Guar's first album without Odorous Urungus, the founder and lead singer of the band and head artistic director, and also a lot of long-running members are no longer in the band. The long-running members that are still in the band, of course, are Balzac and Jizmac, the drummer, and also the latest singer, Blothar, also was a previous incarnation of Beefcake the Mighty in the early 90s. Now there's a new Beefcake the Mighty. It seems as though the driving force behind Guar now is Pustulus Maximus, who joined the band on their last album after Corey Smoot passed away, the previous guitarist. Adam White and Tom Trauma, I've definitely got mixed emotions on this. I'll say it's a slightly different sound for Guar in that it's not so much thrash metal as it is almost like early 80s rock or maybe heavy rock, kind of like Judas Priest. It sounded like Judas Priest and Dio to me.
AC/DC with the dude from Cinderella singing.
Actually, yeah, you're right. So go ahead, Tom. What do you think of this track?
Not much. I've said this before, John. It's another thing that we disagree on pretty consistently. I've never thought Guar's albums were really any
good. Oh, you're wrong, special. Tom. You're wrong.
Well, listen, their live show is great. They're great fun to see. I've seen them 10, 12, 15 times. But their records just don't do anything.
Dude, their records are some of the best heavy metal records ever. Scumdog of the Universe, America Must Be Destroyed, War Party, Battle Maximus.
John, I know that you have a lot of the greatest heavy metal records of all time in your record collection.
I do.
And I also know that those records just couldn't possibly hold a candle to, you know, Screaming for Vengeance. It's not on the same level, or you know.
You think Screaming for Vengeance is the best
Number of the Beast or something? Number of the Beast or something like that. I mean, it's not even the same sport.
Oh, if you ask me, Guar blows Iron Maiden out of the water. I mean, no.
Oh my gosh.
Adam White says that sounds dispute.
He doesn't care. Hold on a sec.
Do you want to know what anyone from the UK town of Oxford is called?
Oxfordian.
Oxhumper?
Oxonian. And here you go. Leeds, as in like the Reading and Leeds Music Festival. What do you call someone from Leeds?
Leadway.
They are loiners. So there you go. So here's the thing about this song. Yeah, it sounds exactly like you guys described it. If you were to play this song to someone, there is nothing in this song that communicates that the stage show would feature like a number of rubber penises. So I feel that like for Guar to work, they have to somehow project the horrific weirdness of Guar, the stage show, somehow through the music that they're playing. Otherwise it's just a rock song that you've heard before, and that adds a little bit more to the argument that I think Tom is making, where you're not really there for the song, you're there for the rubber penises. So,
I didn't say anything about penises, Adam. You brought up penises.
I'm just trying to boil everything down to what we really want to talk about, and that's it.
Gosh, this is my 18th consecutive podcast that I've been on.
It's a normal kind of rock song, and you know, it's missing something challenging, something whimsical. John, you like the word whimsy. It's missing the whimsy.
It is. Like with Guar, there's a certain edge. There's a certain self-aware comedy. I remember when Lordi came out, like everyone thought Lordi was ripping off Guar, and Guar just annihilated Lordi because Lordi just was guys in costumes that kind of sang like 80s cock rock. And it's very disappointing to me that this is kind of what this is. This is kind of just like 80s cock rock. Like, there's nothing edgy about it. There's nothing really next level. There's no commentary in it. Guar is one of the most clever bands when it comes to commentary, pointing out things, analyzing things, noticing things. Here it's just them doing what they've parodied for a while, or kind of, it's not next level. It's a level down, you know,
You know what? It's not dissimilar from the latter day Turbo Negro records.
Yeah.
Where if you listen to like early Turbo Negro, it's almost challenging in how aggressively weird and aggressively perverse it's trying to be. Like you go and listen to some of those early ones, and there's all those fucking songs about like Nambla and stuff like that are on those early Turbo Negro things. There's a hell of a lot of early Turbo Negro songs about sodomy and this and that. But then you go and you listen to some of the latter stuff. I mean, after they switched vocalists and everything, and like the band is still playing the same kind of music, but at least some of the singles that they put out in recent years are, you know, like they're more just competent hard rock songs or competent punk rock songs, as opposed to being this, you know, slightly dangerous, slightly like if I was listening to you know, like Apocalypse Dudes or Ass Cobra or something like that, which I love saying, by the way, you know, like I don't know if I want my wife to walk into the room as I was listening to one of those, because there's things lyrically going on in those records where I think like she would stop and be just like, what the fuck are you listening to? Like, this is, you know, I thought this was one of your punk songs, but this is now crossing a line. And if I listen to some of the new Turbo Negro stuff, you know, it doesn't seem to cross lines in that same way. And maybe this is sort of the same where, you know, it's music in the same vein, but it doesn't have that sense of danger, whimsy, weirdness. Yeah.
Honestly, I think I hate to be negative Nancy, and I'm trying not to get down on Gwar. But it seems to me that this track is like 5 minutes long, which is like 3 minutes too long for this track, first of all. But it seems to me to be a showcase for the guitar player and not much else. And I think the guitar player might be kind of in love with playing guitar, and I think that's where the band kind of isn't doing what it should be doing. I'm a bit baffled as to why Gwar would take a step down from their aggression. They lost probably one of the greatest vocalists. The greatest vocalist in heavy metal. So how do you compensate for that? Make a savage sounding record where the lead singer just has to yell. But instead, they kind of took a step back and focused on vocals and kind of just aimless soloing. And I guess the biggest crime of this song is that it has no momentum, and that it's part A, then part B, then part A, then part B, then part C, back to part A. You know how the song's going to end when you're 45 seconds in and it goes on for 5 minutes, 6 minutes, whereas earlier Gwar stuff would be surprising and have momentum all the way through. So I think it's, I mean, I hate to say it, I just think the band is having a very tough time correcting for the loss of two huge talents in the band. And that's tough to come back from, and I don't want to get too down on the band. But on the other hand, it seems to me that guys that aren't long-running members are kind of running the show, and I just don't understand why. And as a fan, I wish I could understand why, but I can't.
There are at least four rubber penises in the photo that we ran with.
See, if you were listening to this generic rock song with giant cocks shooting fire and people chopping heads off, Adam, you'd be able to appreciate it in context.
What do you call someone from Scumdogia, the home world of Odorous Urungus?
What do you call someone from Scum chopper. Dog? Yeah,
a scum dog.
A cock chopper. Oh, that's dull. Yeah, I was not real high on this song either, John. Like I said, I've never been a big fan of their studio stuff. The fact that you referred to the guy who died, I can't even think of his name, as the greatest singer in heavy metal, I'm sort of shaking my
head. Dave Brocky's without question one of the greatest singers. He is the greatest singer in heavy metal.
Well, you said
he's the greatest singer, right? Because you can understand what he's saying, but he's got a growl and aggression to his voice. Plus, he's hilarious. Plus, he's an amazing lyricist. And he basically, I mean, Bruce Dickinson is like so cheesy. He's like, la, 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 Alexander.
No, I know, but Bruce Dickinson
sucks. Who's better than Dave Brocky? Who?
Ronnie James
Dio.
No
way.
Young Ozzy Osbourne.
No way.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, come on, dude.
No way. Adam White.
Listen, dude. When it, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they didn't. Gwar had a niche in heavy metal, but they didn't have an impact like hardly, you know, like any of the old bands. Well,
they didn't have an impact in influence wise because no one can copy Gwar, because Gwar is so great. Gwar is so unique and so talented and excelling at such a high level. No one else can do what they're doing, except for Alice Cooper.
You know, the only thing I take solace in right now is knowing that lots of other people that are listening to this right now are also banging their heads against the wall with me.
A lot of people agree with me 100%. I know a guy that agrees with me that Dave Brocky is the greatest singer in heavy metal.
You know a guy who agrees with you on that. That is amazing. I mean, it's hard to argue with those stats.
I mean, listen, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I mean, look at it this way. Who's one of the highest selling artists? You know, Justin Bieber. Not that I hate Justin Bieber, but come on, man. Justin Bieber is not better than, you know, I don't know, Against Me. How about that? You know what I mean? But he sells way more records than Against Me. So just because a mass group of people agree with something doesn't mean they're right.
Yeah, but I think if you talk to people who are really what you'd consider heavy metal experts or connoisseurs, I think you'd have a really hard time finding even a sliver of people that would follow you down this treacherous path you've decided to walk.
I disagree, but also I find most heavy metal
You disagree? Well, listen, dude. Show me the money.
I find most heavy metal connoisseurs really aren't that into creativity and interesting stuff, and they kind of want just same old, same old.
Yeah. I don't know. Hey, listen, I think you're crazy, John. You and I agree on many, many things, but we disagree on many foundational
things.
True. So there's no point in us. No point in us rehashing this.
That's true. We disagree on Danzig and Gwar. I think that's
Danzig and the Misfits.
And you don't like Misfits or something?
No. Which era is the best? The album that you think is the best is actually the worst.
Oh, you mean
we won't get into
fair
it.
Fair enough. Adam White, pull us out of this Weeboro style conflict.
Also, the first two Danzig albums are so far and away better than everything else.
No way.
There's not one even a conversation to be had.
Adam White, pull us out of this Weeboro, will you?
Like with real news or with like random
or more
demonyms that I've found.
Yeah, more demonyms.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, so we're done, I think, with the news portion of this show. We've talked about kind of the things that we need to talk about here. I got to make mention of this next thing because at least in my sphere, which is to say Canada, it's incredibly current because this happened today. And I'm amazed with it as just a like a cultural musical moment. So I'm going to talk about this just for a few minutes here. So Gord Downie, who is a singer of the Tragically Hip, he died today of cancer, and we knew he had cancer. It was a terminal illness. The band did a big farewell tour that was broadcast kind of like across the country up here by our national broadcaster that we have, and it's like it was a known thing. Everyone knew he was going to go. But I don't think that has like lessened the weird collective moment that everyone's having up here at right now. And I just want to reflect on that for a minute because it's sort of amazing to be in the middle of it. And I'm comparing this to Tom Petty's death of recent, where. And I was saying this to Tom before the show started. I can't imagine that Tom Petty is any less popular in Canada than he is in the United States. But when Petty died, the amount of, you know, the outpourings that you heard were, you know, they were normal, I guess. You know, people that were fans, and there was a lot of them. You know, they went and they would post something on Facebook or whatever, and you know, it would be, you know, top story in all the news and everything. And then afterwards there was I've definitely noticed, like, you know, playing around with the radio, there's definitely like an uptick in the amount of, you know, songs from Petty's catalog that are getting played at this point. Not anything, you know, super deep or, you know, They're not digging out strange cuts or anything. That, you know, it's all the greatest hits material, but, you know, stuff that from familiarity had just fallen out of playlists as other things had, you know, grabbed people's attention. And, you know, it was a normal sort of popular artist death. It wasn't too dissimilar, I think, up here from, say, like Prince when he died. You know, the usual tributes and the outpourings and things like that. The Tragically Hip Canadians are constantly in this mode where we have to explain the Tragically Hip to Americans because there isn't an equivalent, and it's a band that somehow like captured the national mood or the national character in a way that none other has. And I think by virtue of us being a smaller population, like there's 32 or 35 million people in Canada, right? So it's basically like the population of California. So we're small enough, I think, that like you could have a singular artist that comes out and defines a place in a way that would never fly in the States, where, like, what's the population of the U.S.? Like, it's like
400 million.
400 million, right? Like, you're easily like 10 times what we have, right? And that you have, with that level of population, like, you have such cultural diversity from one area of the States to another, that, you know, you'll have people that will become massively popular, or people that will become, you know, regional heroes or whatever, but they may not have that resonance elsewhere. And, you know, I've heard people talk about how, like, oh, you know, if you're from, you know, the East Coast, you know, Bruce Springsteen means way more to you than if you're someone, say, that was from the West, right? And not to say that he's not popular in both places, but, like, where he's sort of held up as, like, the voice of the people, it's not the entire country. It's, you know, sections that are going to go and identify with that. Something about Gord Downie and the Tragically Hip just captured Canada. And they captured Canada in a way that I've had to contend with as a punk in a strange way. Because when I was in high school, this was the music of the jocks. Like, it was music that the people that I knew that were, you know, like the normals, you know, the popular people, the same people that were listening to fucking Tom Petty on the radio were listening to, like, songs by the Tragically Hip. And for me, as like a young anti everything punk rock teenager, I wanted to be anti everything. I wanted to look at the thing that the mainstream had embraced and say, this is bullshit. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go do my own thing. And I've since Gord's cancer had been announced, I've seen that difficulty voiced by, like, a number of people in the punk rock community, and written about quite eloquently in a few places. And it's amazing to me that, like, there's that shared level of the experience here. So, I mean, Damien Abraham from Fucked Up wrote an article that was in Vice or Noisy or something like that about how, you know, exactly what I'm trying to voice here. Well, where, you know, if you're trying to be a counterculture person in Canada, then the thing that you want to do as a counterculture person is immediately be like, you know, fuck the Tragically Hip, just because it's like, you know, it's like Johnny Rotten and saying he hates Pink Floyd, right? Like, it's, you of course want to do that because you're tweaking what the popular opinion is. But Damien has this great article that he wrote about how that, like, Gord's, like, I don't know, like, his, like, his beauty as a human being and his skill as a wordsmith and his just general, like, goodness as a person and as a citizen, it sort of chips away at your need to reflexively be against this popular thing. And then you end up being, like, incredibly endeared with it. And there was an article that Razor Cake ran a few years ago too, by there was an Ottawa writer. I'm just trying to, what was her name here? By Jennifer Whiteford. So she was at one point in a punk band called Sophomore Level Psychology. And she was the creator of a zine that was pretty popular called Matilda. But she wrote, like, the same thing where she was on tour with what was, hold on, I got it right in front of me. She was on tour with Warriors, like, not Warriors, Warriors, W-O-R-R-I-E-R-S, right? And and Lauren from Warriors commented to her that, like, oh, everyone in Canada must, you know, must be, like, completely enamored with the Weaker Thans all the time. And it was like, well, actually, like, everyone in Canada is, you know, enamored with the Tragically Hip all the time. But then, and then, like, Lauren's response was sort of like, I don't know who that is. And, like, that's constantly, like, the thing that we're thrown into, where we're like, it's, this band is the biggest band in this country by far. Like, they would sell out, you know, the biggest sort of, like, outdoor festival things that you could imagine, but you would put them across the border by, like, you know, 200 feet and no one would give a shit who they are. And just that even exists in the internet era, when everything should be equally accessible to everyone, is just amazing. Like, it's just bizarre. It's weird. So I've been trying to contend with, you know, like what do I think about this band and this guy and everything that people are saying, and am I being too swept up in the, you know, in the patriotism that has kind of crept through, and you know, and what he's kind of come to signify as being one of these like mainstream Canadian artists. And I mean, like, the Canadian cultural industry is all celebrating him and, you know, and his life, and they have been for the past year or so. So you want to look at all this and say, like, you know, like, do I still have my own thoughts about this, or am I just being sucked in by, you know, the prevailing narrative? And it's fascinating. But there was a quote that I saw that Danny Romano, the former singer of Attack in Black, he does like a whole bunch of crazy country stuff right now. And I was looking at the statement that he posted, and Daniel's one of these people that, you know, he's a florid writer himself. So the language in here is a little fun, but one of the things that he said about Gord here sort of resonates to me. And he said, like a burglar in the night, he crept in and filled even the most ignorant, oppressive, and hate-filled minds with subtle secret wisdom and liberation. He was a valiant soldier of words in an industry plagued by rats and cowards. And I like that description of what Gord Downie does up here, because he championed a lot of like Indigenous rights issues, environmental issues, and he made these things, and not only that, I mean, so he championed these issues, but he also was like, he was a legitimate poet. Like, he wrote poetry, he published poetry. For him to go and to insert not only like social issue stuff, but this very kind of like literate sensibility into what's essentially like music for the jocks is kind of interesting. Like, there's something sort of subversive about that I really like. So anyways, we're all, this is everywhere right now. We sat down for dinner tonight, and you know, my daughter went and turned on the radio, and you know, the one station it was on was just, you know, nothing but Tragically Hip songs. And then I got in the car to run over to the office before we recorded this show. I turned on the CBC. It was playing nothing but Tragically Hip songs. I changed the station, different Tragically Hip song playing. Changed the station, some other song that immediately ended, and then another Tragically Hip song started. So, like, the death of Gord Downie here, like, in Canada, it's all consuming. It's everywhere. But I'm sure if I would have went and flipped the station to one of the stations out of Buffalo, because I'm right close to the border and they all come over here, it wouldn't be mentioned at all. And it's amazing. Just that is amazing. I don't know. That's what I'm trying to express, I guess. I'm not expecting anyone to have any particular feedback on this. It's just that this is what's happening right now. It's, I couldn't not mention it, because it would be like not mentioning that your house is on fire. Like, it's everywhere all the time. So anyways, that said, I was going to go play something like legitimately punky that had some sort of Gord Downie connection here, because, you know, I'm trying to be cool, and I could do that. I mean, there's a fucked up song that he appeared on that I could play for you. He played a whole album with the Sadies that I could play something from. But hey, whatever. I'm just going to play a Tragically Hip song to close off this show. So here's something that's totally not punk, but, you know, it's from something that matters a lot to us in the North for whatever inexplicable reason. So this song is called Family Band. It's from the Tips 2006 record called World Container. And here you go. We'll be back in a sec. But
and that was the tragically hit with I would say an eloquent elegy from Adam White. You can always use podcast at punknews.org. Tom Trauma, any last words, anything you want the listeners out there to know?
No, not at the moment. I'm just like my mind's been like wiped clean by Adam's speaking about Gordy and the tragically hip. So
Adam White,
see you later, kids. It's been fun as usual, except for talking about the death. But other than that, it's been fun as usual.
I didn't have fun when you guys were arguing over if the singer of Guar was the world's greatest human being. That was tiresome.
Well, you should go out and listen to the albums, Adam. That way you can form an opinion.
You should go listen to the albums, Adam, so you would agree with me next time I'm on.
Unfortunately, John, I'm pretty sure that even if I was in Gord Downie levels of love with all of this Guar stuff, I would probably not go and rate him as the best ever.
I would, man. You haven't heard Guar. That's your problem. We'll see you next week, listeners.
What I love, what I love about John is he always doubles down. He always doubles down.
He really is the best singer, though. He really is.
Are we done, or are we still?
I don't know.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.